ask you about how it felt to sort of write in the book, to really open up about your, shall we say, financial journey.
I mean, that is the nicest that question has ever been phrased. Yeah, I think if you bought a biography by me and I didn't mention being publicly shamed over tax, you would feel shortchanged. Very much like HMRC did. I mean, I held my hands up, I apologised, paid it back, but it couldn't have gone any worse. People are interested, I think, now in, do you want to know how much money I saved in tax? Yeah. Like the actual figure? Yeah. You interested to know? Yeah. Fuck all. Despite quite a lot of effort on my part. It couldn't have gone any worse. I'm the only person in this room, I'm confident saying it, the only person in this room that would have been better off financially taking advice from a Nigerian general over email. Every day's a school day, though. Something like that happens, and you learn a thing or two. You know, I've become quite the expert in tax. Oh, I'll give you advice on it right now. If you get a letter through from HMRC, do the responsible thing, pop it in the recycling. Don't worry about the letter. They will send another letter. Okay. Those cunts love a letter. If, on the other hand, keep in peel for this, if the Prime Minister of the country that you live in breaks off from the G20 summit, he's in a meeting with the 19 most important people in the world, and he comes out early to a press conference where he talks about nothing other than your personal tax affairs, that is going to be a problem. Although, in my defence, I never fucked a pig.
Do you feel that you've been sort of forgiven by your following? Like this reaction now, do you feel that kind of seals that, yeah, a man shouting yes?
I think I got lucky because, you know, the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion, if you're not aware, about 18 months in prison. I came down on the right side of, like, it was a dodgy thing to do, but it wasn't a legal thing to do. People were very forgiving. I tell you, it was the nicest. Builders and black cab drivers. Like from building sites around London. Well, you've done nothing wrong, son. And every taxi driver, why? Yeah, they fucking turned you over, didn't they? It's going to be cash, though, isn't it?
What was the reaction amongst, like, your colleagues in comedy?
I mean, it was the great thing was, you know, there's that lovely phrase, we cannot forgive what we cannot punish. It was quite easy for me to see what to do. Some people get cancelled over something and they don't know what to do and they won't be forgiven and it lasts forever. And for mine, it was like, pay it back, say you're sorry. Okay. Mm. And people were pretty nice about it and I sort of took my medicine. I was on 8 out of 10 Cats this week. I was doing a topical comedy show about the most talked about things this week. And I was the most talked about thing. Mm. And often you credit comedians or people, the on-screen talent, with being clever. And I wasn't. But my producer was clever. My producer, Ruth Phillips, took me to one side and said, you've just got to take it. Mm. You've got to take your medicine and just let them rip into you and don't say a fucking word. Mm. Do not clap back. Mm. Best advice I ever got. Mm. Because Sean was on the show. He was fucking brilliantly funny. He said, everyone prepares for a rainy day. You're more set up than Noah. So good. I was among friends. Mickey Flanagan was there. I mean, you know where Mickey's from. He's done a couple of scaffolding jobs for cash. Sarah Millican was so funny and so warm. And like, it was like, I felt like I was amongst friends. They ripped into me. And that was like being in the stocks. Mm. And tomatoes thrown at you. Mm. And you take your medicine. And you say sorry. And it's over. It's done. I mean, the effect on me long term was it really hit me. I think a lot of people thought I was quite cool with it. Mm. Like that I would be, because of the kind of comedy that I do, I'd be fine. My anxiety flared. I didn't sleep for about 4 or 5 days. I was taking some medication. I was zombie-like for the week getting through it. And it really, I felt like I was going to lose everything. And I kind of, you sort of realise how much you like your life.
Yeah. And did you have people around you? Did you have people supporting you? Or did you ever feel like...
I mean, I had my... Yeah, I mean, you really find out who your friends are, which is awful in a couple of respects, where you thought, oh, I thought that guy was a really close friend, and then they were kind of gleeful that you'd been brought down a peg or two, and you go, but I'm not interested in fair weather friends. I'm not interested in people that are just there for that. I like a foul weather friend. I remember James Corden was doing One Man, Two Governors on Broadway when the story broke on the Monday. And he called me on the Monday night in his interval, like he's got 20 minutes off in this very physically demanding show. And he phoned me and just went, you're right? You're right? No one gives a fuck. You're fine. Still, we got you. You're fine. And I really needed to hear it. And it meant the absolute world. And then I said, oh, thanks, whatever. And then he called the next night and did the same thing. And again, you still need, and then the next night, and the next night. And I really felt cared for and looked after, and like, you've still got your mates. And you never forget that. And I suppose the lesson from that, and the thing that I put in the book is, if you've got someone that, a friend, a relative, whatever, that's going through hard times, call. I always call now on the day. Mm. And even if it's something embarrassing or weird, or you're not quite sure what to say, just phone a guy, I don't know what to say. Mm. It's so much better than not calling.
Your anxiety.
Thanks.
You mentioned there your anxiety. And that's, again, that's something I just had no idea that you ever suffered from. You seem so impenetrable when you see you in these kind of high status hosting roles on TV. And in the book, you talk about kind of, was it a lifelong battle with anxiety? You wake up anxious.
Not really. Yeah, I wake up at about 5 a.m. with a panic attack most days, more often than not, which isn't great. But people have got it worse than me. You know, I don't need to medicate. I can kind of white-knuckle it. I try and see... how many people suffer with anxiety? By round of applause.
Yeah? Yeah.
There's a lot of us, right? And the way that I see it is it's the kind of negative side of having a creative mind. So your mind is racing, so you're going to overthink things. And there's methods of kind of dealing with it, but I try and see it as a positive and go, look, all of the good stuff, okay, so it comes with this as well, and that's okay. I think the more that people talk about it and share, the better. Because, you know, the thing that every therapist should tell you, I kind of say it in the book, but every therapist should sit you down and go, you know, there's other therapies, it's not just me. Because I'm not really interested in the Freudian sit on a couch and talk about your relationship with your mother. I know where it all comes from. So that thing of like, what am I going to do to deal with it? And that thing of like going, well, it could be CBT or it could be NLP or something, you know, those therapies are available and they're really sort of valuable and really work.
And you've really kind of walked the walk there. Like you describe from a really inside perspective how those different therapies have affected you because you've done loads of that stuff. There's a moment in the book where you refer to dancing the five rhythms during a thunderstorm. And I honestly couldn't tell whether that was you taking the piss out of hippie bullshit or a thing you've genuinely done.
I've done all that hippie bullshit.
You've done it.
All of dancing the five rhythms. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Beautiful experience. walking on hot coals.
Okay.
Fucking nothing. Don't worry about it. Pointless exercise.
Is there good and bad therapy? Do you like undergo a
stuff,
thing and go?
I think there's a lot of therapy. The walking on coals thing is just to like G's people up, but it doesn't specifically tell them what to do.
Okay.
So you get a lot of kind of excitement, but then what's the next step? What am I going to do next? Mm-hmm. And I'm much more into the therapy, and the stuff that I tried to put in the book was that stuff of going, okay, so what's tomorrow? What are we doing next?
And are you motivated to write about it from the perspective of working through it for yourself as much as from the perspective of trying to help other people?
At the end of the book, I sort of do, right at the end, I sort of do a little summing up of like all the things, and I read it back and went, I do about half this shit about half the time. But I'd be a fucking superstar if I did it all. Mm. So part of the act of writing is to kind of remind yourself, oh, actually, you should do more of this.
And there's something about your job. There's something about doing stand-up comedy and the fact that relies upon having a healthy relationship with failure that probably, like, that helps, right? That you can lean into the idea of failing, get comfortable with it.
Well, if there's any reason to kind of write the book, it's to kind of to get away from the Instagram world of perfection that people see, because all you see on Instagram and in the social media world is perfection. You see results, and you never see the hard work, and you never see the anxiety, you never see anything else. So stripping that away, I think, is quite important, because it just seems impossible. I think there's a lot of young people that look at that stuff and just go, it's just a perfect world that I'm not part of, and I don't feel like that. I mean, you have this weird sensation now where people are sort of jealous of their online identity.
Yeah.
Because they're so sort of far removed from it. I'm always smiling in photos, but I don't feel that way inside. Mm. And there's a mental health crisis with young people because that world is being portrayed. and people can't live up to it. They can't possibly live up to it. Yeah, yeah. It's terrible, right? I think I talk in the book about, quite arrogantly, about comedian superpowers, the things that comedians do better than anyone else. And one of the things is failure. Mm. We're really good with failure. Because, you know, if you're trying jokes, I've written more jokes that don't work than anyone else in the room. Maybe you. But, you know, we write a lot of jokes. That wasn't a dig. But that thing of, like, I've written so many jokes that don't work. I've pitched so many shows that didn't get made. I've failed more at comedy than anyone else. And that's what led me to success. And, you know, like, owning that failure and, like, being proud of your failures and, like, that's the kind of battle-worn thing, that's a great way to live. That's a great way to kind of, just to think about it differently.
Can you teach someone, or could you teach yourself to get better at failing, to become more comfortable with failure?
Yeah. You fail in... I mean, the trick is not to fail the same way every time. You fail differently every time, and then eventually you sort of practice so much you kind of practice till you can't get it wrong. Mm. Yeah, that's...
Can you give us an example of something you've fucked up recently?
I fuck up things all the time. I think owning it's quite an important thing. I've got a couple of stories about, like, in the book as well, about, like, fucking up and owning it and being responsible, and that seems to work. It's a story. I told it on the news recently, but I'll tell you. So I went to test drive a Tesla. I didn't go to test drive a Tesla. I went to the shopping mall because it was raining. But I was bored, and me and Caroline just thought, all right, we'll go to the shops. Went to Westfield, this big shopping centre in Shepherd's Bush. There's a store in there. We've got coffee and food and stuff. We're looking around the shops. There's a store that sells Tesla cars. And I'm amused, because I'm from a different generation, that you can buy a car in a shopping mall. That seems dumb to me. So I went in there and got chatting to the guy. There's a really charming guy in there. And he went, would you want to take one for a test drive? And I went, what, now? And he went, yeah, we go right now. And I went, yeah, let's do this. It's exciting. And then we went down. It's one of these ones with the gull wing, zoom, like Star Trek doors. It's cool. And we get in it, and Caroline's next to me, and we're whizzing around. It's like a go-kart. They run like go-karts, right? It's really fast torque. I like it. I don't need a car. I've got a car. Don't need a car. Just a bit of fun. I told the guy that. Fine. So we're driving around Shepherd's Bush. Great. This is lovely. Thanks very much. Better get back. And we got back into Westfield. If you've been there, it's fucking enormous, and we got lost in the basement. And so the guy from Tesla goes, oh, right, if I move those cones over there, with just the charging stations over there, we're going to be golden. So he gets out and he moves 5 cones, and so I can drive through. And obviously he's 20 yards over that way, so I just go, well, I'll go and collect him. I hadn't realised his door was open, hit the door on a gantry. Zoom. Hit the door, took the door off. It was hanging by one bit of cable. So it was like the Terminator, but it wasn't dead yet. Still had the light in its eyes. And the guy's face, I couldn't see that because I was in the car until I got out. So I was just looking at his face going, oh, that's not good. You know that look you get when you've knocked the door off a brand new Tesla? That look. And I just unwound the window and went, I'll take one. Obviously not this one. This one's fucked. So I now own a Tesla.
On the subject of failure and coping, I guess, one of the things you said in the book that really stayed with me is you said, take the worst thing that your inner critic says, walk back the cruelty, and you'll find the truth about you. So with that in mind, take the worst thing your inner critic says, walk back the cruelty and find the truth. What's the worst thing your inner critic says to you?
I think I could be better. I think I've got a lottery ticket. Like that thing I was saying about luck. I think you sort of make your own luck. And it's hard work and application. And the talent thing is like, that just is the illusion. That's what you see. I think I could be better. I think I could work at it harder. And I think coming out of the pandemic, I'm trying to rewrite the show and write better material and change up my style a little bit. I'd like to be one of the greats. I'm not, but I'd like to be. And so that true north is like, you're sort of aiming for this thing of going, it's also, comedy's like a task without end. Because you can always get better. You could always be funnier. You could always be a bit sharper. And changing stylistically from doing one-liner stories to slightly longer-form stories is like, it's a really interesting thing that I'm working on. I'm working with my friend Amanda Baker at the moment, who's here, who sort of directs my live show and also sort of directed the book, like was like pushing me to write, tell more stories and do more things. And I think working with someone is really valuable and just trying to get better. I think your inner critic is always going to go, well, look, you could be... This could be funnier.
Is it possible to continually be striving and yet be satisfied at the same time? If you're always wanting to be something better than you are, like if you're not satisfied with the sort of the very high level that you've achieved.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned, but this is a self-help book, so I have to say in it five times. That's the legal requirement. It's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah, right.
I like being a comic. I like the road. I like doing gigs. I like performing for you this evening. I fucking
you like the showbiz parties.
I love it.
Here's a question. Louis C.K., at the end of Louis C.K.'s latest special, he thanks you. What was that for, and are you close?
Yeah, we're friends. And, I don't think anyone is the worst thing they ever did. I think if you're friends with me, you're friends with me, and that's for life. And I guess it was for that.
Fair dues. On to the... Four people trying to start a round of applause, then giving up. Oh, fair.
Fine. Yeah, I think it's I think that's probably an example of being a, not to blow my own trumpet, but to be a foul weather friend is a magnificent thing to be.
Serious one here. Garden, mushy, or petit pois?
I'm going to go... petit pois. I'm going to go petit pois because that guy is such a fucking... He's brilliant. I don't know what's the matter with him. I'd go with a mushy pea. I'm going mushy pea with
mushy.
The fish and chips. Yeah.
Working great. Class roots. There we are. Were you the funny... This is verbatim. Were you the funny fucker at school or a big girly swat?
Actually, great question because I was both. When I was... You're 16, right? Okay, you're 16. When I was 16, I changed schools. And you become acutely aware, and I think this is a great thing in life, you become aware you are a story you tell yourself. Like, I don't believe in an afterlife, but I believe in a next life, because it's happened to me a couple of times. Mm. When I was 16, I moved schools, and I went from being quite a tearaway. A lot of friends from that school ended up in prison or in a lot of trouble. A lot of them didn't make it, some of them died. It was a rough school. And then I moved to a better school and reinvented myself and went, yeah, I'm going to be an academic and go to Cambridge. And I did it with my job. I had a boring job, and then I reinvented myself as a comic. And I'm still the same guy, but you go, you can be different things in... You can't beat your environment, and sometimes changing environments changes everything. And by environment, I mean not just the place you are, but the people you're with, who you're surrounded with. And when I found the comedy environment, when I surrounded myself with those people, I liked who I was more, and so I stayed there.
Who's your best mate? Who do you hang out with? Are they famous or just a normie?
Wow, that's a very good question. Normal people, I remember them.
It is, but it's funny you talk it. You do mention once or twice in the book some of like old friends. I find it's quite hard to visualise you hanging out with a mate you went to school with that isn't Stephen Hawking or Elton John or something.
A lot of my close friends are slightly kind of father figurey when I analyse it. Yeah. I've got a friend who's like a professor of biotech. Take the fucking vaccine, you idiot. I've got a friend who's a biotech guy in property. A lot of kind of older guys. I mean, yeah, I've got lots of close friends. I've got some that are in the business, some that aren't in the business. But yeah, I value friendship above all, I think. It's the, you know, it's fantastic. Because love is unconditional. You have to love certain people. But friendship is conditional. If you like fast-paced, edgy one-liners, get ready to be happy. I'm announcing a new tour. It's called Jimmy Carr Laughs Funny, and I'll be touring all around the world. Come and see me. If you don't like fast-paced, edgy jokes, then it's not for you. You know, get some perspective, maybe just jokes.